Okay, welcome everyone to this excellent session I'm expecting on the practical application to banking risk management in the consideration of climate change. We know insurers and banks have been around for centuries, but the environment has been relatively constant, and this is trying to practically deal with the fact that that's changing rapidly. So very quickly, I just briefly introduce our presenters today who've put together a comprehensive paper. We've got Ruby Smith, who's a qualified actuary working in Finity's climate analytics practice, focusing on physical risk transition risk and long-term climate-related issues. Sharanjit, as many know, he co-leads Finity's perils and climate practice and advises insurers and banks and investors and governments, and has a numerous list of climate-related awards ranging from Actuary of the Year to Insurance Leader of the Year to Risk Manager of the Year from various organisations. So that's Sharanjit. Sen is an independent consultant specialising in quantitative risk management for banks and non-bank lenders, and has specialities in credit risk modelling, capital management, model development and validation engagements, amongst many other things. And John, who is online, he's the founder of JE Advisory, an independent risk management consultancy, and he's got expertise in enterprise risk management frameworks, having led a function there at CBA in that area, and his focus is on strategic risk and balance sheet management and advising organisations on risks generally, but also how to include climate and sustainability risks in that. So I will now hand over to Ruby. Thank you.
Is the president coming?
It's on my screen here.
There
it is. Okay. Welcome, everyone. My name is Ruby, and I'm joined by Sharanjit, Sen, and John, who's online. And together, we wrote a paper about the impact of climate risk on banks' residential lending portfolios. And our presentation today, we won't go into all the details of the paper, but we're going to focus on some key actions that banks can take to incorporate climate risk into their risk management frameworks. So the agenda for the day, I'll give a brief introduction to climate-related risks. John will then give a brief introduction to credit risk management for banks, and then Sen, Sharanjit and John will delve into those key actions that banks can take. And we'll finish up with a summary and some questions. So there are three types of climate risks: physical, transition and liability. Physical risk refers to the risk of direct damage to assets or property caused by changing climate conditions. These can be acute physical risks like storms, floods, droughts, heat waves, which are increasing in frequency and severity. And then there's also chronic physical risks, which arise due to longer-term shifts in climatic patterns over time, like changes in precipitation and temperatures, which leads to things like sea level rise and biodiversity loss. Transition risk is the risks arising as we transition to a lower carbon economy, as we seek to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. This can include things like policy, market, reputational, legal sort of risks that carry financial implications to the economy. And finally, liability risk stems from the potential for litigation if institutions do not adequately consider or respond to the impacts of climate change. Within our paper, and therefore this presentation, we just focused on the impact of physical and transition risk on a bank's residential lending portfolio. So physical and transition risk can impact bank customers with home loans in many ways. Physical risk, primarily, the impacts are driven by insurance and repair costs. So due to the changing climate conditions, we are seeing increased damage to homes and associated increasing repair costs. We are seeing increased insurance costs and the effect that this is having on insurance purchasing decisions. We're also seeing a reduced availability of insurance as homes are becoming more uninsurable from an insurer's perspective. And we're also seeing the impact that increasing extreme weather events have on house prices. On the transition risk side, this primarily impacts bank customers through household budgets and local economic conditions. So the transition is impacting employment and income opportunities, as well as expenditure patterns and behaviours and property values. So all of these physical and transition risk impacts ultimately affect two things. They affect the ability of the customer to meet their mortgage repayment, which is the serviceability component, and they also impact the value of the mortgaged property, which is the security of the bank loan. And in credit risk language, it's the probability of default and loss given default impacts of climate risk. So we can't control climate risks, so we need to understand them. And in order to do that, we can conduct scenario analysis. And the progress to date in this front has been mostly led by regulatory exercises, which have been designed for a different purpose. Regulatory scenarios are designed for financial system stability, not to assess specific granular risks. The NGFS scenarios, for example, which are the industry standard climate scenarios, they are global scenarios, not specific to Australia, let alone an Australian bank's risk. So banks need to design and conduct granular targeted testing to assess the impact of climate risk on their lending portfolios. I'll now hand over to John, who will discuss the brief introduction to credit risk management.
Yeah, thank you, Ruby. So Ruby's explained what we mean by climate-related risks, but the other important foundational piece we need to cover is how banks actually manage their credit risk. That's what I'm going to cover in this short section. So credit risk, as many of you know, is the primary risk for lending institutions such as banks. And it's the risk that customers will be unable and importantly unwilling, which is an aspect that's often forgotten but is pretty relevant when it comes to climate context. So unable or unwilling to repay their loans per their contracts. It also covers the risk of not being able to recover any monies lent in the event of a default. So banks operate a credit risk framework to manage this risk, and the key components of it are shown here on this diagram. So basically there's four key elements to it: a transactional piece, a portfolio management piece, a management of residual risk, and then underlying that, all of that, the credit risk modelling piece. So I'm just going to run through those briefly in turn so you're clear on what each of them covers, and then you'll be able to understand their relevance to climate risk. So on the transactional side, this is all about a loan origination and the conditions of those loans. So it defines who we will lend to and on what terms. The key components in here start with risk appetite settings. So this will articulate any types of lending that the board is unwilling to take on. So it acts as a screening tool on those loan applications that are being made. If an application passes that screening, then it'll enter the decision phase, which is where the banks really do three things. Test the applicant's ability to service that loan, decide the price or the interest rate that's going to be charged for it, and also define the security the client's got to hold or provide against that loan. So moving on to the portfolio side, this is about the management of the back book of the bank's loan portfolio, and it's about maintaining a portfolio mix that the bank's comfortable with. Again, that really means being within the board's appetite, but also it probably means not having too many high-risk loans that could come back and cause problems in the future. So components in here really are concentrated around, funny enough, concentration risk. So concentration limits exist. These are typically limits the amount of exposure the bank's willing to have to certain types of counterparties, to certain industries, or to certain geographies. Also in here is risk transfer tools. Now, really, once a loan is on the bank's books, they're generally stuck with that loan until it matures or it chooses to leave and refinance elsewhere. But there are some ways of managing that credit risk in the portfolio using things like credit default swaps. So that's where Bank A and Bank B will swap the loans, the losses from different sub-portfolios so as to diversify the sources of the losses they've got. Another aspect that's kind of not well or talked about a lot, but is important to banks, is banks use assets such as home loans to support securitizations. So this is where the bank transfers credit risk to the note holders, and it provides a really important source of funding for the bank. But the price the securitization can command will depend on the quality of the underlying assets, or home loans in that case. One final piece in here, which often is forgotten, is the customer optionality piece. And this is another aspect of portfolio management. It refers to the ways that customers actually behave in practice, such as their propensity to refinance or pay down their loans ahead of schedule. And that changes the risk profile of the portfolio, obviously. The key thing to note here is that these customer decisions are largely not within the control of the bank. The third piece of the framework here is the management of residual risk, and this is about calculating and setting up financial protections against the potential future credit losses. And it's really to ensure that we have sufficient financial protection for the risks in the portfolio. The two really key components in here that you'll hear a lot talked about in banking circles, provisioning, and that's the money set aside against future expected losses from the credit portfolio, and that directly impacts the P&L of the bank. And capital. So this is the amount of shareholder funds required to be held against future unexpected losses from the credit portfolio. This is really is a key driver of the return on equity that banks can offer. And the appropriate amount of these will be informed by scenario analyses and stress testing, important component of understanding the risk, as Ruby spoke about earlier. So it's really about understanding the range of possible losses and also the sensitivities of those losses. The last piece of the framework underpins all of the other three, and it's the credit risk modelling piece, which is about the tools and methods that are used to quantify and understand the level of credit risk exposure that we have. Key components in here, and Ruby mentioned them earlier, PD models, so these calculate the probability of a loan actually defaulting. And LGD models, loss given default. So it calculates how much of the loan we might lose in the case of it defaulting. All of this is informed by data and assumptions that are essentially causational drivers of those measures. And the models are used to derive credit loss distributions, which then inform the expected and unexpected losses, which feed directly into provisioning and capital respectively. So those are the components of our framework, but when it comes to climate risk, the big question is which of these elements and subcomponents are impacted by climate-related risk? Well, when you consider the purpose of these, as shown on the right-hand side of the slide here, it would be pretty hard to imagine that any of them aren't impacted. And of course, if the credit risk framework is impacted, so are all the business processes that actually implement that framework into frontline daily activities. So what this means is that climate-related risk impinges on pretty much every process that supports credit decision-making across the organisation. So embedding climate-related risk is a really significant task for a bank. So with that background, we're now going to look at some of the priority processes that banks need to address as they face climate-related risks. So I'll hand over to Sen to take us into the next section.
Thank you, John. So we'll talk through 8 actions that we've identified now that we've set the scene in terms of what climate risk is and broadly how banks manage their credit risk. These are the actions that we've identified as key actions that banks should undertake to embed climate risk considerations into their risk management framework. I won't read through them, but we will step through each one and explain sort of how that can be embedded and why, as a bank, you'd want to undertake those actions. So I'll start with understanding the potential impacts for a lending portfolio and also knowing the uncertainty around your assessment of the impact. So if we start at the bottom left-hand side, you need to understand what the risk is. And Ruby talked about how the risk translates to PD and LGD. There's a significant body of scientific and research knowledge that you need to be somewhat across. There is the impact of policy responses. So climate's changing, economies need to decarbonize, and there are policy responses that support that change. And that has impact for the borrowers. And talking of borrowers, essentially your credit risk is driven by the impact of these changes on the economics of the households that are your borrowers. So firstly, what does it mean for the household margins? So we're talking about income less expenses. Income and expenses will be affected by transition risk. It'll be affected by employment opportunities, the cost of energy, the cost of transportation. And similarly, physical risk impact things like the cost of insurance, the cost of recovering from disasters, et cetera. It also impacts the household balance sheets. So the value of the property is a key part of credit risk as well. It drives the LGD. And then the scenario analysis and stress testing. As Ruby mentioned, a lot of that to date has been driven by regulatory expectations, but it's a key tool for a bank to understand, firstly, what is the level of risk in the portfolio, start to gain an understanding of, you know, how that sits relative to your risk appetite, and then from there, as a bank, you can start to know what steps to take to manage that risk if it is significant. A key part of climate risk is that it's different to the way a bank thinks about credit risk. So banks tend to take a portfolio view, tend to look at drivers of credit risks like macroeconomic factors, so GDP, unemployment, interest rate, house prices. But credit risk, climate impacts are very granular. So if you think about physical risks, that can change from one end of the street to the other. If you think about transition risk, your impacts can be very localized depending on the industry. If you're in an area that's dependent on coal mining, for example, then you could be at risk. So there's very granular specific impacts, and banks need to shift their thinking to understand that. The second is talking about dialing down unwanted high-risk originations. As a residential lender, the origination process is your key control on the level of risk that gets accumulated in your portfolio. And your underwriting process is key to ensure that that risk-taking is in line with your risk appetite. So incorporating climate considerations into your underwriting aligns your risk-taking with your risk appetite. Secondly, it enables you to grow in line with your business and strategic objectives. So rather than having restrictive controls to avoid taking on too much climate risk, if you were to implement it at a granular level, you could continue to lend and grow with confidence. And finally, meeting investor and regulatory expectations. So the mandatory disclosure standards, for example, require you to tell investors and regulators and stakeholders what you're doing given the risks that you've identified. And so a key part of that would be monitoring at the very least and reviewing your originations. The challenges are avoiding friction. Banks live and die by the ease at which people can access their loans. People want to want certainty of funding. You know, when they put in a mortgage application, they want to know that they'll get a loan, they can then go out and make offers or bid. Brokers want that as well. It makes it easier for them to get the loan across the line and get funding. So banks have to think through how they do this. You know, what data is required? Where will they get the data from? At which point in the process do they need to get the additional data? You want to avoid having to go back to customers and or having to refer a lot of applications, so you need to think through the process. And that obviously requires data and modeling. And then the third challenge is around responsible lending obligations. I won't delve into this, and we'll talk about it when we talk about engaging with the customer. But that's a very important part. Banks have, you know, potential reputation risk on the line, and you want to make sure you treat customers fairly. One thing that we point out is that it doesn't have to be a comprehensive, complex implementation, and there can be a range of options that's available to a bank. So if the risk in your portfolio currently, and given where you're originating and your distribution channel, means that you're not going to accumulate significant amounts of risk, you could just monitor and not necessarily include that in a lending criteria, for example, but just continue to monitor the accumulation of the risk. At the other end, you could incorporate climate risk into your PD-LGD models and rate customers at an individual level, including climate risk. That would obviously require a significant amount of model development, collecting extra data, incorporating it into your metrics, being able to explain the decisions that come out of that. So that's at the extreme end, but that might be warranted if you are got significant customer base in areas that might be exposed to both transition or physical risk. And then you need to look at the types of controls. So banks typically do things like have lending limits, have serviceability ratio limits, or security requirements are typically expressed as an LVR requirement. So lending limits work better for things like transition risk. So you might have geographic lending limits, and this would need to be fairly granular, so things like SA4 type definitions. But you need to think about that for physical risk. As I mentioned earlier, physical risk is could be very different. And so using things like SA4 or postcodes may be too much of a broad brush approach, and you could be missing out on opportunities to lend. Serviceability metrics could be adjusted, so using more realistic estimates of things like home insurance premium, which can be quite expensive depending on where the home is located. So that works better where the risk or uncertainty from climate affects the borrower's income or expense. And then security requirement, that might be applied where you've got concerns around the impact of climate on the value of the collateral that the bank provides. I'll talk a bit about credit risk models. So as John mentioned, the credit risk models are a critical tool in credit risk management. So they provide you information on the level of risk you're taking. And typically, the models serve three purposes. One, you might have a model that discriminates or ranks borrowers based on their characteristic. And so if if the model doesn't include climate factors, it does not provide this discrimination effectively. So the approach is to start incorporating exposure or factors that link exposure. Credit risk models tell you the expected level of losses. So it's a key input into provisioning. It goes into your balance sheet. It's poured over if you're a listed bank by security analysts. And if you use historic data to calibrate these models and estimate your losses, you could potentially underestimate losses under climate scenarios. And finally, the models estimate a downturn loss, so the unexpected loss component that John talked about. That's used, for example, in ensuring capital adequacy, setting target capital levels, and your capital management buffers. Now, climate risk can change what may be a downturn. A recent NGFS paper suggested, for example, that you might want to start considering the interaction between climate and macroeconomic stresses. So banks typically tend to run a big macroeconomic stress with a 30% housing downturn, 5% increase in unemployment. But what the NGFS is suggesting is that potentially those downturns can be exacerbated by things like transition risk or climate risk. So considering short-term scenarios that include the interactions would be a way of sort of looking at whether your stresses are adequate. Of course, all of the modelling requires a lot of data. So I'll hand over to Sharanjit to talk about data.
Wouldn't be an actuarial conference if we didn't talk about data. So here's our requisite data slide. So as we've talked about, and John started by saying, all these credit risk models, all the risk management framework is underlied by data. And we've also talked about how climate change is different and how to the typical risks considered by banks and therefore the changes in the data requirements. So I think we've touched on and the need for address level hazard data. And I'll illustrate that in a second. But also understanding insurance costs. So insurance is the main control used by banks to manage physical risk. But if that is, you need to understand, are those costs, what costs are your customers facing, and how well are they even able to buy cover? We've also touched on transition risk a number of times, and I'll illustrate this with a quick example. Suppose you're a bank, and someone comes to you and says, I'm a baker, I would like to have a home loan, please. You'd say, okay, doesn't really matter what happens with climate change, we're going to need bread. So you seem to me to be like a low climate risk, and therefore I'll lend you the money. Great. But what you don't know is that that baker's main business is providing bread rolls to the local catering company. Every day he gets up and he makes 1,000 bread rolls and he sells them to the local catering company. And what you don't know is that catering company has the major contract for the local coal industry to outsource all their catering. Suddenly, this risk goes from being a very low transition risk to being a very high transition risk. And that's the nature of transition risk. It is an economy-wide, you have to think along the value chains in order to understand the impacts. But our view is that it's a very geographic impact. This is what APRA said before in their climate vulnerability assessment. Different regions will be affected by transition in different ways. So part of this is having a deep understanding of the local economy, as in, there's a coal mine here, that bread provider might be providing it for the coal mine. We think that that local economy and that geographical layer is very important. And this is in contrast to banks at the moment, who very much look at macroeconomic national-wide statistics rather than what's happening in the Hunter Valley or what's happening other places. The other thing here is, in the credit risk modeling framework, and as we've talked about, you need to validate your models. Now, one of the issues the banks have is they haven't accurately recorded whether a particular default was related to a natural disaster or was related to the local coal mine shutting down. Many banks have been trying to look through their data and try and figure this out, and they're coming up with nothing. And this is difficult because, you know, you could have the flood today, but someone won't default until 2 years down the line, right? And so how do you then go back and attach these things? So understanding these is going to be very important in order to validate your models on a prospective basis. And it's a big data requirement for banks. Again, a lot of the impacts here depend on what the market are doing. So, for example, if one bank starts to pull out of a certain area because it's a high flood risk, well, people can go and get loan money from other banks, right? But as that dries down, suddenly people are going to say, you can't buy there because no bank will lend you money, and then you'll get the property price impact, right? So you have market effects. So you really need to know what your competitors are doing. A, you don't want to necessarily go too fast because you may miss out on business, and you may trigger property losses by your actions. And B, you don't want to be the last man standing or the last woman standing and taking all the risk that no one else wants. So understanding your market is very important. And the last one here is understanding what happens to house prices when we get disasters in certain areas. Historically in Australia, this has been really hard because that's not what's driven the market price, right? Supply issues and incentives have been what have driven our market values for houses. But we're starting to see differences. Looking at Lismore at the moment is a very interesting property market to look at. So you need to track that better. Something that comes from one of our models at Finity, where we have address level pricing. This shows you a particular region, and the red dots are the high flood risk and the green dots are the low flood risks. All I want to point out here is that houses, even standing next to each other, can have very different risk prospects. So banks typically will do kind of any underwriting and risking like on a suburb level or on a postcode level, and that's not going to work, is the basic thing. You're either going to leave money on the table or you're going to accept risks when you think you're not accepting risks. And so particularly with things like flood risk and bushfire risk, you need to have address level pricing. The other thing I want to say is that insurers have known this for 20 years now and have been pricing these risks on a house address level. We no longer have risk pooling when it comes to pricing in home insurance. Many people don't know this, but the banks are going to have to learn the same lessons. So just touching on that insurance one, you really do need to understand how insurance is affecting your customers. Insurance, as I say, is the main risk control that's been used by banks. The way we approach our analysis is to look at when does that risk control fail? Because that's when you start becoming exposed to the risk. There are four ways insurance would fail as a control. First of all, it doesn't actually cover the risks. So, for example, home insurance typically does not cover coastal hazards, doesn't cover you from heat stress effects. That could mean that people don't want to live there anymore and there's no jobs there and everybody moves out and property values go. Good luck claiming on your home insurance because it does not cover you for that, right? This was quite interesting. I remember a meeting some years ago sitting with one of the large banks, and their CRO was on the other side, and I was talking about this, and they were really shocked because they hadn't realized that they weren't covered for coastal inundation and erosion. So just, you know. Secondly, we've touched on this, insurance could be unaffordable today. In a separate paper, we estimate that 1 in 8 households today faces insurance more than 1 month's worth of income. We think that's pushing it towards the unaffordable level. Or it could increase over time and become unaffordable in the future. And lastly, there's all the transition risk impacts that impact on household budgets and their ability to pay and what's left over to pay their home insurance. That can also crunch on this affordability problem and means that insurance doesn't work. So one thing we would emphasize is that affordability is a problem well before availability or insurability. We see insurers typically push up the price before they pull out of the market. And generally, that's what we're seeing. You do need to understand what's covered by insurance and not covered. Many banks will require you to have buildings insurance, but in the same policy, they won't say including flood cover, for example. They'll just say buildings insurance. So people go out and buy building insurance and exclude flood cover. And what we're saying here is that, you know, one thing you may consider is annual validation that your customers have insurance. We don't suggest you do this across your whole portfolio. That is a big waste of money and will annoy your customers. You should do it for only the high risks. And if you have the right systems and data, you identify the high risks and you go and ask those people. We also talk about customers. This is a huge part, and particularly because this sits under a lot of reputational risk, a lot of that banks have suffered. You don't want to go through another a Royal Commission, and potentially, you know, if we're talking 1 in 8 households, that's a big potential issue. You also have to think about responsible lending. If you know someone's house is going to be underwater for most of the year in 10 years' time, is it responsible for you to lend them that money to buy that house? Question. You also need, if you do things, you do need to think about how you explain them to your customer. You may be, like the insurance industry has been for many years, the messenger that gets shot when you tell someone that your house is at high flood risk. You may be the person who's the first person to tell a customer that you're not going to lend them money because the house is in a flood area, right? So are you set up for that? And that is a complex distributional problem. You've got to think about your channels. You've got to think about education. You've got to think about training and skills. You've got to also have evidence because customers will complain and you will be pulled in front of the regulators and the ombudsmans and you will have to justify your decisions. This is hard. For new customers, you can kind of be the good guy. You can say to them, please don't buy this house because it's going to be in a flood zone and you may want to think about your insurance costs, and that's great. However, you also have the same problem with your existing customers because a large part of banking finance on a year-to-year basis is refinancing existing customers. And what if your existing customer comes back to you, you do a climate risk assessment, you say, holy hell, they're in a flood zone, we're in trouble here, right? How do you react in that circumstance? What we think about here is using your existing vulnerable customer framework. We think that is a good way to approach this issue. This customer is now vulnerable because of these situations. You have to think the implications through for that because it may mean raising provisions, it may mean capital adjustments, it may mean a whole bunch of other processes that you have to think about. But certainly we think that framework as a starting point is a good point, a way to start. Lastly, wanted to talk about new products because actually, my view is this is a massive opportunity for the banking industry. It's actually a way that the banking industry can do a lot of things. So the idea is, and you have to start with this, take your high-risk climate customer and lend them more money. What you do is you lend them more money to improve the resilience of their home. Make the house flood-proof, improve their bushfire resilience, use that $23,000, that $30,000. Why does this make sense? Well, one, it reduces your risk. Two, it ensures your customer can carry on buying insurance. Three, it gives you extra lending at a good rate of return. And four, if you remember what John said about securitization, you get all these loans, you bundle them up, you securitize them, you sell it to the crazy Europeans who will call it a climate bond and give you discounted funded rates, and you increase your net interest margin. It is a massive opportunity. It's now being enabled, so NAB is actually doing this now through the Resilient Buildings Council. It's a third party that can provide certifications for customers on the street to work out what they have to do and how to pull this together. And this is going to be a big issue going forward. The insurers need the banks to do this so that they can carry on insuring the house. The government needs this to happen because they can then not have to bear it on the balance sheet. I am conscious of time, and I'm going to hand over to John. We'll keep the slides up so you won't see John, but you can see the slides. Thank you.
Thanks, Ranjit. I'm going to skip very quickly through these last slides because I'm conscious of time. I want to leave time for questions. But this is the last point we wanted to make. It's an important topic. It's about disclosure. You'll hear disclosure talked about a lot about when it comes to climate and ESG. But gaining all of this insight and changing our process is great, but it's really important that we do tell our stakeholders what we're doing. That's the purpose of disclosure. And as a bank, you have a very wide group of stakeholders. You can see them listed here. And really, they want to know what you're doing in relation to climate risk. And fundamentally, they all want to know that. For one reason, do they want to continue to do business with you in the way that it happened in the past? So what is it you need to tell them? Well, the key thing is that you give them credible information that really helps them make their decisions. What does that really mean in practice? Well, it probably means information that's aligned with global best practice. That makes it comparable with other potential opportunities they might have, particularly if they're an investor or a shareholder. That what that means that now is basically getting in line with the new accounting standards that are coming out from the IASB. Previously, that would have been sort of TCFD-aligned disclosures. It's also really important, though, that you give them a clear understanding of the risks and opportunities that you face from climate risk, and also what your strategic plan for addressing that is alongside how you're progressing versus this plan. Of course, in making disclosure, we often hear the word greenwashing. You need to be very careful about what you're disclosing because over-disclosing or being selective, let's say, about what you're disclosing can lead you with fines and regulatory action if you aren't on top of this. And the ACCC and ASIC are all over this, as you are probably aware. So just skipping through the next slide, if somebody can, and we'll skip there. The TCFD, I mentioned that. The last thing is just to show you what does this look like in practice. Well, at the moment, here's a disclosure from 2018 from CBA. It had some nice charts, some maps that really gave a good idea of where the exposure to climate risk was in their home loan portfolio. But really, disclosures need to go beyond not just the what the risk is, but also how, as I say, how you're responding to this. And that is an area that's not particularly well described. That seems to be driven by two real factors. One is that fear of greenwashing claims. But secondly, it's this balance that I'm showing on the right-hand side here between transparency and market sensitivity. So what concern could be raised with customers, with industry, or the market reaction to the information that's being disclosed? It's a hard thing to reconcile, but does lead to some very interesting and ethical questions within organisations. Okay, I'm going to hand quickly back to Ruby just to conclude before we get to questions.
Yeah, just a really quick summary so you guys can fire away with questions. First and foremost, you need to understand your potential impacts. Once you do, you can then make further decisions like dialing down high-risk originations. You can update your credit models. You can improve your data sources if you know what sort of data you need. It's important to know your properties, not just your customers. You must understand insurance and engaging with your customers and disclosing to stakeholders. Okay, so yes, please, any questions?
If anyone has any questions online, please send them through. Okay, Elaine?
Can I just make a comment?
Yes.
Lending them more money so they can spend some money on fixing their house or making their house more resilient. You mentioned a number of advantages of that. A huge advantage is making Australia more resilient, but that's what everyone wants. Yeah. So to me, that's incredibly important, and I haven't really heard that before, so I was very impressed. So please, that's happening. So thank you.
Very similar comment and question. Again, I'm glad you touched on resilience. The Actuaries Institute and the Insurance Council of Australia played quite an active role in sort of encouraging, I guess, whole of economy policy setting in adaptation and resilience that's touching on building codes, land use, and so on and so forth. I'm interested in understanding whether the banking sector is similarly coming together to figure out how it can contribute to the national interest.
Yeah, look, as I mentioned, then NAB has been one of the big sponsors for the Resilient Building Council, but they're not been the only ones. We're seeing lots of initiatives by the banks because this is really important to them. You know, insurers can kind of walk away. You know, they can walk away from these high-risk properties. Did they really want to insure them in the first place? And, you know, they'll lose some revenue. Banks will lose assets. Right, the value of the market is, I think, $1 trillion worth of assets out there, something like that, in housing assets. That's a lot of money to lose 1/8 of. So yeah, the banks are definitely at the table and coming to sort this out. I think people are kind of getting their heads around, okay, well, if this domino falls, what happens to that domino? What happens to that? The RBA last year released a report, their financial systems report, and they called out this issue. They called out the issue that if we don't have insurable assets, then we don't have financing around them, and that will cause a systemic problem. Yeah. It's something, actually, that we'll be doing some more work on this year when we do a home insurance affordability report. We also want to look at how much lending is associated with insurance that we think is unaffordable, and you know, what kind of issues would that bring to the economy?
Okay, there's another question from the audience. Yes.
Just on physical risks, it looks like you're presenting that the bank's going to do a physical risk assessment similar to what the insurer already does. So, how would you see this, I guess, playing out in practice with the bank's team, the insurers? Does the bank just build in-house capability?
Well, you know, all the banks got rid of their insurers over the last 5 years. And, you know, I certainly was at the table telling a few of them that maybe they should think twice about this because they've actually just lost the capability that they would need internally in order to do this. Works for me as a consultant. They're employing me to help them do it, you know. But, yeah, look, I do think so. I do think there's also a lot of partnerships developing between banks and insurers on this. What's interesting is that I'm seeing most of those partnerships happen in the LMI space because that's actually where banks talk to insurers a lot and insurers talk to banks a lot, and we're finding that that's kind of where a lot of the conversation is happening. But, yeah, banks will need to be as good as insurers on this in some shape or form. They will need to think about what's the best way of doing that. We're seeing some banks invest massively in that capability and starting to do a lot of work in here. CBA, for example, puts like a 100-page report on their analysis. Not all of it physical risk, but a significant part. Yeah.
Okay. I think we're on time. Does anyone have any other questions? I can throw another question if you want. But okay. Sharon, I'll just give you one question.
Okay. Might throw it to John as well.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I'm John. What are the challenges at the underwriting stage in terms of equity, particularly given a mortgage will be 30 years long, but who knows what climate scenario will play out, and we can't really predict the insurability cost in the future?
Yes. This is a big issue. So, I mean, we discuss it in the paper as well, that a lot of this analysis for climate is done on a scenario basis, but you don't necessarily have probabilities associated with those scenarios. So when you're doing your credit risk testing and you're doing it under different scenarios, that's great, but then what's the number you actually put? Like, do you base it on this scenario? Do you base it on that scenario? Do you base it on some other scenario? That becomes very difficult to do. And, you know, there's a number of approaches that we talk about in the paper. You know, the usual thing, take an average or look at the most likely scenario and those types of pieces. We don't know yet, and I don't think the banks know yet. I don't think the regulators know yet what should be the basis. And then, as you say, there are lots of equity impacts. You know, you could be someone who'd be fine under, you know, if temperatures rise by 2 degrees, but not fine if they rise by 3 degrees, and you'll be affected by those different scenarios. And, you know, there are going to be equity impacts on this, as we know.
Okay, thank you. Look, we're over time, but thank you very much for a wonderful session, informative session.